Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Smina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm Dr. Smina Rahman, a sex med gynecologist and menopause expert in downtown Chicago. And I'm super excited and privileged to bring you guys an episode today. It is a true honor to be sitting down with a legend in urology, Dr. Arthur Bud Burnett, the Patrick C. Walsh Professor of Urology at Johns Hopkins University. He's a trailblazer, not only in research, but as a surgeon and an educator, whose pioneering work on erectile physiology helped make Viagra possible. Dr. Burnett is more than a scientist and talks more than science. He's changed the conversation around sexual medicine for men and, as a result, for women as well. His latest book is The Manhood Prescription, Every Man's Guide to Improving Sexual Health and Overall Wellness. It's a guide for men, and I argue for anyone who wants to understand vitality, intimacy, and aging well. And so today we're going to talk about a lot of things related to men's health and how it relates to partners that I treat in my office. And so thank you so much, Dr. Burnett. Welcome to my podcast.
Well, Smina, it's my delight to join you, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much. Well, I mean, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about, I always like to get origin stories, you know, like my logo is a superhero gynecologist. So I love a good origin story. So can you tell me a little bit about what brought you into the field of sort of urology and specifically men's sexual health and what inspired you and how you kind of went into the sexual medicine arena and you became the president of SMSNA and all of the great things that you've done. But what kind of brought you into the field in the first place?
Well, you're just wonderful to ask that question. You know, I when I hear that question, I have to take a pause and say, yes, I guess I've come a long way. as you're right, I'm a professor here at Johns Hopkins in the Department of Urology and have been a surgeon scientist by a career. I mean, it's kind of almost my moniker, if you will. Yeah. And my origins kind of go back, I think, in time, perhaps even to college years, where I was just fascinated by hormones and how the body works. Worked on projects back then to try to understand the science of sexual dysfunction. Believe it or not, studying rodents at that time and hormones in the brain. But then went on to residency, obviously medical school, then residency. Just fascinated by how chemicals work in our bodies and regulate different functions. And got involved with the science of erections, even back in urology residency, and made some of the original discoveries on nitric oxide, penile erection. That was the foundation for Viagra and the other drugs. I've maintained about a 35, almost 40-year career now of just continuing to make impact in the field. And it's just seeing how well that we can address these so important issues in men and women, their sexual health, which oftentimes, unfortunately, does seem to get the short shrift of things. But we make discoveries and really are trying to advance the field.
Wonderful. I love that. And I think that, you know, we always talk about, and I'm friends with Dr. Mohit Khera, I'm sure you know as well, who, you know, has kind of coined the term sex span when it comes to, you know, a couple and how they age together and how that changes their sexual function. You know, one thing that I've noticed is, you know, one of the biggest controversies in women's healthcare, at least hormonal midlife women's health right now, is testosterone. And it's so interesting when I speak to urologists because when men are testosterone deficient, they get replaced. And it's really easy and it's not a controversy usually, I think. I mean, I know some of the data's changed around heart health and some of these things, prostate cancer awareness around testosterone replacement. But, you know, it's been a real struggle for women to get the testosterone they need that may help their sexual function and potentially other areas. Can you talk to me a little bit about how, as a urologist, you approach sort of testosterone replacement in men, you know, who gets it, how important and vital testosterone is for men's health?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I agree with the role that testosterone plays in men and conceivably in women. I'm glad they're getting some attention. That is part of some of the activity of sexual interest, sexual drive in both men and women. And obviously, men have a much higher level based on organs that produce testosterone, the testes. And how do we go about evaluating it? Well, we assess patients for any presentations of sexual desire that wanes and is perhaps not the way it used to be, evaluate some other clinical parameters, get a blood test for testosterone levels. If it's deficient, we know that at least a normal range should exist. And if it's below that, that gives us enough reason to consider a trial of testosterone therapy. And so just fundamentally, it's a matter of an evaluation. Among the, you know, I guess you may lead up to how do we kind of decide who merits this. And we do have, you know, an opportunity to speak with a patient, review their health history, review their sexual functioning. Testosterone as a therapy has a more major role in sexual interest and sexual desire, or libido, as we call it. Mm-hmm. Erectile dysfunction is slightly different. Testosterone may modify that, but yes. I would communicate to the audience that, you know, it may not be the be-all and end-all just to help erections recover. And we can get into more discussion on that if you wish. But yeah. Basically, as you say, it's a matter here of evaluating the patient for symptoms and doing some clinical testing, including a blood test for testosterone levels.
And I think it's interesting is that obviously it improves sexual function, but for most men with low T, it's like really, you know, it can actually tell us more about what's happening with their overall health and what they are at risk for.
Well, no doubt. I mean, and certainly I just kind of spoke a little bit about the sexual arena. Sexual dysfunction has some testosterone dependence, but we also are learning more and more about how testosterone is so vital for so many other aspects of the health in a normal range, not super physiologic, but in the physiologic range, it may have potential advantages for bone health, for some aspects of physical health, cognitive functioning, how we think and stay alive and how we think. So, and there's a whole list of things that certainly endocrinologists are very keen about. Those are hormone specialists with regard to testosterone being impacted for our general health. So I'm a supporter of all of that. And I think that certainly evaluating those patients very comprehensively to try and determine whether testosterone has benefits even beyond just sexual health now is something to consider.
Absolutely. And so you talked a little bit about the erectile dysfunction, which I'd like to touch on because, you know, as a gynecologist who treats women, I always ask, you know, who they have sex with. And if they're having sex with men, you know, the next question is, you know, if you're a midlife woman with maybe genital urinary syndrome, menopause, what's happening with your partner? Because we know men experience their own transitions as they age. And so, and we also know based on some studies that, for instance, men who have Peyronie's disease or erectile dysfunction, it can actually contribute to female sexual dysfunction. So can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the evaluations? Well, let's talk a little bit about erectile dysfunction. I mean, obviously the nitric oxide pathway was so critical in some of the medications we're using now, but tell us a little bit about when you evaluate a man who comes in, you know, because obviously, you know, what I find was so interesting is I had a patient just last week who told me that her husband had erectile dysfunction, but he didn't want to go get assessed. And she's like, can you see him? And I was like, no, I'm a urologist. But, you know, I see so many women that have so much shame and stigma around it that it's so interesting that obviously, you know, for men, it's even probably more to some degree because, you know, their sexuality is supposed to be so much a part of who they are. Just sure. Like, you know, women. So can we talk a little bit about, you know, what it's like when men come to you with those concerns and how you go about treating them?
Well, you know, you speak to, you know, a number of things that are true to my heart. And, you know, we understand that sexual activity, sexual function often is a couple's matter. And if one partner is experiencing some difficulty, conceivably, it could be the other also either having some dysfunction or maybe having some sort of contribution to that problem, and therefore the couple is dissatisfied. So it kind of goes both ways. You just enumerated that. You know, certainly women may have some difficulties that may exacerbate a man's dysfunction that's changing. And on my side, seeing men commonly, if they start to have dysfunction, you know, they may have some ramifications with regard to how well the woman responds to that, a female partner in a heterosexual relationship, although there are others as well. That can be a positive or negative. Much of the time it can be negative because that person is also either dismissive, unhappy. That may contribute to that man's sense of his manhood, may demean him. And this gets to the bigger, larger point that I think as we evolve and how we manage patients with sexual dysfunction, we think of it in a broader model now, a biopsychosocial model, and also put a cultural context into this as well. And all of this is to say that we understand that sexual function is not just a matter of just getting an organ to function. It's the whole being. the mm-hmm. organ being the sexual organ, and how that, and looking at it in a very broad context, and you asked me how I approach men. Well, I approach them really holistically. Mm-hmm. I review with them really the identifiable aspect of their sexual dysfunction, but also put it in perspective with regard to how it's impacting their own interpersonal lives, their own perhaps even their own sense of their own well-being, and really try to bring that into some sort of context, and certainly do it in a non-judgmental way. Do it without mm-hmm. trying to bring about any sense of shame, because rewrite anything that surrounds sexual dysfunction in men and women, and certainly in men, which I can speak with, does have sometimes stigmas related to it, does have a sense of shame and this and that. So I think that we as healthcare providers need to always stay upbeat, try to figure out how we can be in a positive way of mind about, okay, let's see, here are the problems. We're not judgmental. How can we help? We may bring somatic therapies, and we can get into that a little bit, but also there may be some sexual therapy and mental health aspects too that may be combined with some of that, and we can get into some of those discussions as well.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those therapies. I mean, we all, you know, again, I talk about the biopsychosocial approach a lot in my own, in this podcast. So most of my listeners know that that's how we approach things in sexual medicine, which is great. But I think, you know, people just assume that the treatment for erectile dysfunction is just Viagra, like, and then people do just fine with that, which—
You're absolutely right. They just think that's it. Send them out the door.
You know, even in women's health, they're like, oh, well, men just have to pop a pill and they're all good. But we have all this. But it's really more nuanced for men as well.
Yeah, men are emotional too, sure.
Right. So, I mean, talk to me about who you think would benefit the most from some of those traditional medications versus, like, you know, I mean, it's all nuanced in my mind. I don't think just one person could take a pill and that's the end of it. But, you know, do you have a team approach? Do you use pelvic floor PT in your office as well? Or how do
you? Well, I think, you know, as I was mentioning before, I think it's, you know, useful to, you know, in a global way, just support the man and support the couple. Yeah. But then try to get a handle on really what is the sexual dysfunction. I think we've made strides in the past few decades to be a little more precise about that, because mm-hmm. I think we can then hone in on what kind of interventions make sense. I mean, in the past, as you know, eras gone by, we would just have men come in the office and say, my Mano is not right, my Johnson's not working, or whatever. And that's first of all, not only is that a little bit pejorative, but at the same time, it wasn't really helping us understand, is it a matter of your sexual libido? Is it a matter of your erection not performing? Are there some ejaculatory orgasm dysfunctions? So we've really understood the sexual response cycle in men and in women, and bringing this along in women too, you know that, where we try to understand what is the issue, because just throwing, you know, anything against the wall and let it stick is not the way that we solve health problems. You know, we need to try and understand what the issue is and bring forward the right interventions. And if it is a matter of erection difficulty, that man may have other health issues such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, other things that really changes how the vascular and nerve function in the penile tissue work to bring about an erection. We have therapies there. Now we understand the science of erections better. We brought about these oral medications now in the past two decades or so. And beyond that, we have other options. So we know that these are all good, but at the same time, we're not only just focused on the penis now. We got to think about that man's holistic health. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned pelvic floor physical therapy, mental health therapy, sexual function therapy. And I do work in a collegial way with other specialists that can certainly help me co-manage patients. And of course, I present it to the patient to understand in this kind of shared decision-making kind of context. You know, how far do you want to go, sir? You know, I don't want to force anything on somebody, but mention that we have the opportunity based on their values, their preferences, maybe even culture and religious things about how they want to proceed. And then we try to avail them of all the right specialists that can help them be as whole as they want to be.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I mean, I think that's kind of the way to go when it comes to some of these things, because at the end of the day, you know, we know how much culture and religion so play into our perceptions on sexual, how we view sex in general. So I think that's why it's really important to incorporate all of that as well. The book that you just recently released, Man's Prescription.
Yeah, Manhood RX. And I wrote that about it came out about a year and a half or two ago. Okay. And we're actually working on another book, believe it or not. So we're excited about trying to
get,
I've written a few books. Yeah, I sure have. You're right. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about Manhood RX and, you know, why you wrote it and what it kind of reviews for the people that are wondering, like, you know, if it's my audience that's maybe more women than men, you know, what is it that they can garner from that to help their significant others if they're in a heterosexual relationship? You know, tell us a little bit about what made you write the book and what information we can gather from it.
Sure. So that book was written, Manhood RX, with the thought that it addresses manhood issues surrounding sexual dysfunction, the kind of sexual dysfunction men encounter.
Quick reality check. If you're listening to this and thinking, why does no one ever talk to me like this in my doctor's office? That's because most doctors aren't trained to, nor do they have the infrastructure for it. That's why I started the GYN and Sexual Medicine Collective, my new concierge practice where sexual wellness, hormone health, and gynecology actually come together like they're supposed to. No 10-minute visits, no gaslighting, no have a glass of wine, relax. Just evidence-based, shame-free care for women who are done settling for bad sex, brain fog, hot flashes, or feeling invisible. I'm proud to be part of the Ms. Medicine Network, which means your care is rooted in science, not stigma. Find us at www.thegsmcollective.com and book the kind of appointment you wish you had had years ago. Your body called and wants its power back. Let's go.
Bringing kind of an authoritative view as a perspective, as a specialist in urology, a male health sexual dysfunction specialist, it's mm-hmm. meant to be there in a way that's can be useful to those who want to get some sort of orientation to different conditions and how to manage it. It's not over medicalized. But it's certainly people may want to pick it up and still understand conditions and know how to proceed. And this ranges from everything from erectile dysfunction to penile deformities like Peyronie's disease, conditions like priapism, where erections are persistent uncontrollably and has some devastating consequences in certain populations, including men with sickle cell disease, all the way up to sexual dysfunctions after treatments for the conditions such as prostate cancer and overcoming some of the stigma there. So again, this gets back to the point, the stigma related to these subject matters, good authoritative texts are needed, mm-hmm. I think unfortunately in our, and you're doing a great job with this podcast, for example, because I think so much is going on out there that can be misinformation, mm-hmm. a lot of information that's just not by people who really are the true authorities with real understanding of the field and communicating some truths about what's real and what's not real. And so it was meant to be kind of a go-to simplified encyclopedia, if you will, because I don't want to say it's that because I want to make it sound too complex. It's easy to read, but it gets some information out there. And, it addresses what I thought was a need at that time.
Wonderful. Yeah. I mean, well, actually, since you mentioned Peyronie's, because I mentioned it earlier with the patient of mine that I had a spouse that had Peyronie's disease, and we talked about it. And she had no idea. She and then her spouse came in with her the second meeting. They had no idea there was a treatment for Peyronie's. And it's so interesting to me that, you know, so little is really discussed, especially this. I mean, I think erectile dysfunction is a little more well known in the communities. But when it comes to something like, you know, that curvature where people think that there's nothing I can do about it. And so, you know, she was like, we only have oral sex now because I can't have, you know, when I asked her about it, that was what she told me. And she was so surprised that there was actually treatments available. And I told her about a little bit about Xiaflex. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what Peyronie's is and how we treat it?
Oh, absolutely. So Peyronie's disease is a kind of a global term about penile deformity. And the various manifestations of what this deformity is, it's benign, not cancerous. And it can occur at about 1 in 10 men, oftentimes getting in their 50s and 60s. So it's a common thing, 1 in 10 men. Yeah. And it's almost just one of these sort of acquired conditions where our bodies start to change. In men, the penis, which is supposed to be this powerful structure, really is kind of delicate internally, and it can acquire some scarring in it. And when it's scarred, it interferes with how the penis really changes in its shape when an erection occurs. And the penis can do all kinds of things. It can bend one direction or another. It can get some narrowing in some places. It can actually be somewhat withdrawn and not really lengthen, and therefore a shortening effect can occur. All of this having to do with this benign benign, not cancerous, scarring effect within the penile tissue. So kind of an interesting kind of disease state, but really can affect a man, but not just physically, but psychologically, because mm-hmm. it really causes some distress. And you can see how it disturbs the relationship, just as you described. So it is a condition that we want to bring attention to, recognize, not keep it in the shadows, a taboo subject, to come forward. Let's talk about, you know, how we can work it up, understand the extent to which it causes structural changes in the penis, whereby the penis is not insertable, or changes the quality of the erection, the rigidity effect, because the scarring can also change the mm-hmm. firmness of the erection. And so this structural and functional aspects to it. We try to define the extent of the problem patient by patient, and then decide upon what treatments we have that's available to address what that sort of mm-hmm. issue is, almost on a personalized medicine kind of perspective. We now know that we have treatments that can more or less straighten the penis or structurally change the penis. If the erections are poor, we still have the oral erectile dysfunction medications. Unfortunately, and I'll just say this up front, I wish we could say that as common as this condition is, we had a very simple just pill mm-hmm. to take or simple cream or ointment just to rub on the penis and the scarring goes right. away. That's a little bit, at this point, mm-hmm. over the top or mythical in terms of we have something that's too simple. But know that, mm-hmm. Patients should get into the office, talk to somebody who specializes in this. Know that, you know, we're very eager to be of help where we can deal with this in a very forthright way, bring forward to some management options and try to get you back in the ball games.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think that's great to hear because, again, you don't hear about it as much. And, you know, some people are like, this is just our life now. We just, you know, she can only have oral sex and that's what it was. And so it's good to know that we are evolving and getting more and more treatments available. But you're right, then none of them seem to be that simple.
Yeah, and I don't want to say it in such a way that it's doom and gloom, you know. Yeah. And I've had patients say, "Well, if this is so prevalent, why hasn't science made better strides?" And in truth, you know, dealing with scarring in different parts of the body and deformities, many times it still requires more scientific investigation. We're just not there yet to do simple treatments, but we can go about fixing this. And sometimes it is a surgical matter, but if necessary. Let's bring what we can to it and help that man and the couple out here.
Yeah, that's great. And speaking of surgery, I know you have done, you know, so many thousands of surgeries, and one of your areas of expertise is in the area of prostate cancer. So, you know, cancer recovery and the sexual dysfunction that comes from that. In my area, we always talk about, you know, how women recover from breast cancer and how it affects their sexual function and how, if someone has, cervical, vulvar, all these different cancers, how it can really, you know, prevent them from thriving once they've survived the cancer. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the sexual dysfunction that you see post-prostate cancer and how prevalent prostate cancer is and just because that's something I don't think I've touched on this podcast yet.
Yeah. So prostate cancer and its consequences is really a hot button topic and certainly deserves attention. Obviously, it's a man's condition. So understandably, it's not occurring in women, but it's comparable to what you're saying in women, you know, from the just perspective that, you know, once your sexual function can change with prostate cancer treatments, it can have a lot of impact, a negative impact on the patient, the couple, their sexual well-being, and so forth. So it's an important topic to discuss. Prostate cancer, just to make the remark here in terms of how we understand how prevalent it is, about 1 in 9 men in America will get prostate cancer. It's the most common non-skin cancer in men in the United States. And so it's very common. And treating it is the issue. The disease itself doesn't alone just cause erection difficulties or sexual dysfunction issues, really. But treating it either by surgery, radiation, or even hormone treatments, which are classically the interventions we offer, surgery and radiation if it's early stage, hormone treatments if it's more spread in the body to try and shut down how these cells can progress because they're so testosterone dependent, these prostate cancer cells. But we've known for decades now that if a man undergoes a surgery for prostate cancer, he has a high risk that all the nerves and blood vessels deep in the pelvis where the prostate has been surgically removed can be damaged in a way that the erections that happen with the blood vessels and nerves nearby where the prostate was get impacted negatively. They get damaged in a way that erections are lost. And historically, it was universal. But also know that radiation, again, because of where the prostate is in a very precarious part of the body, gets impacted by radiation too. So radiation is not devoid of risk either. Right. Now, of course, we want to treat prostate cancer. As devastating as it is, it does claim lives. But the consequence for many has been the trade-off of losing sexual function. And also urinary issues can arise too, because urinary control is in the same area. I think we've made great strides in the field. I think there's so many different aspects surrounding this, not just supporting the man and the couple surrounding the biopsychosocial aspects of this, but also things like just do the surgery better. We've done nerve-sparing operations, and what that means for the audience is just how we've learned in the past couple of decades to perfect our surgical technique so that we least damage the surrounding tissues with nerves and blood vessels. And deep in the pelvis, very complex anatomies to all of this in terms of how our bodies work. But just doing the surgeries better has led to many men getting their functions back. And on top of that, we're talking about new ideas for helping the blood vessels, the nerve tissue rejuvenate, heal up, restore function. And we're making great strides ahead, and I think in the field to help guys not feel that they've got to trade off, if you will, their cancer control and then lose sexual dysfunction. We want to make it win-win in all respects.
Yeah, no, that's very, yeah, I think that's something that I find my women, my female patients experience too, is that they get the cancer treated and then that's it. Like no one thinks about their life after the cancer and, you know, whether or not it's becoming hormonally deficient and going through an accelerated menopause that's affecting their whole body or their sexual function, they're just forgotten. And so I think that, you know, emphasizing that, so happy to have survived it, but now let's get you to thrive and live a better life. And so, the sexual function tends to be a very important part of that. So I'm glad that.
Oh, absolutely. You know. Survivorship is key here. And I think that we're recognizing that we need to do more as healthcare professionals than just treat a patient and say your cancer is cured and then see ya. No. Yeah. We really have to consider the impact of what we're doing and how we can do things better. But while executing treatments, but also post-treatment for the cancer with other interventions that address the whole person and maintain their sense of wellness.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's great. One thing that I'm very interested in some of, you know, you yourself as a pioneer, is as a woman of color, I talk a lot about disparities, not only female patients, but even like, you know, women of color in medicine. And so I want to talk a little bit about like the medical and racial disparities you see when it comes to some of the health conditions that you treat and, you know, how we as a society can do better for these patients. I have a lot of healthcare providers that listen to my podcast, and soon I'm going to be merging with this group called Pinnacle to get CME related to the podcast. So I want you to talk to, you know, not only the patients that are listening, but the providers, like how we can do better to not dismiss our patients and overall. So if you can talk to us a little bit about the disparities you see in men's sexual health, because I oftentimes will talk about disparities in women's sexual health.
Absolutely. Well, I applaud all that you're doing. And I think it's so important to recognize the healthcare disparities, the reality that that is so. And healthcare disparities occur surrounding all health aspects in individuals out there. And it's occurring on all different levels, from patient provider to you know, even health care system and access issues and all these other kinds of things that all you know, you see it's really multifactorial. But I think we need to recognize that our country is diverse. People come from different backgrounds. There are cultural contexts, religious contexts of how we manage. It's great that we have providers like you and me that can also kind of bring a little more perspective. And if not, be, you know, somebody that patients say, I want to see somebody that I think knows my background and understands me. And that's not to say we can't treat everybody and even those who are not in ethnic populations that they can't move forward in a positive way. I just want to make sure that everybody just hears the context of this and understands that we all can move forward in a very purposeful way. But in terms of the issue of healthcare disparities, unfortunately, I think it is a reality. And the reality of it is that there's consequences whereby those who are somewhat less able to access care, get the best aspects of their entire life of exposures to good health environments. There's social determinants of health that do disproportionately affect certain ethnic populations, from nutrition to health, to food security, to sanitation, to just general well-being and where they live and environmental things. All these things affect general health, but it can also encroach upon sexual health as well. And I think all of this is important to recognize. You know, and this, I've certainly heard from many different mentors and other experts in the field that in our country, we make so many great discoveries. And while we do, the amazing phenomenon is the more good discoveries we make, many times that even increases disparities. And whenever there's great improvements in certain areas, unfortunately, by way of challenging access to care, those in certain ethnic environments actually may not be able to acquire the best health interventions that are being even developed. And that's just a sad thing. And that speaks to aspects about access to care too, a little bit. But all of this is to say that it does exist. We do need to recognize that. I do think it needs attention. Why do I say that? I think there have been wonderful studies out there that show that if we address the healthcare disparities of all individuals, we actually improve the societal health. And this has actually been studied on a financial level as well. And, you know, so the old adage, you know, a rising tide rises all ships. I think it kind of applies here. So there really is some logical discussion. There's a reason to address issues. If we leave out certain groups and then they get delayed care, that's more costly to our healthcare system, that leads to early mortalities, deaths from certain populations. It's not a good thing. So I think we need to recognize it, address it in a very, you know, kind of positive minded way. And in terms of how we can deal with this on individual levels, you know, I think that any of us healthcare providers, then let's try and work with our patients in a very complete way as you would handle management for anybody, and try to bring them the best care based on guidelines, and bring them the